I sent bunch of mails. I believe you guys also signed up for the project presentation schedule, and there's going to be a paper presentation schedule this Friday also. So Michael just opened a thing himself. Just write your names. I think we'll have to figure out. I mean, it has to be probably, it just has to be in the last two classes. I would have things to do before. So I realized that people who started writing late got later and later. But that's okay. I think these are all the people, right? This is the only project that need to be presented. Okay. We'll figure out, maybe we'll just reduce the number of minutes per person. Or if I actually get done like middle of, you know, the 11:20, why 11:20? Oh, that has nothing to do with that. Okay. Yeah, and then the presentation this week are these, essentially. Okay. Yes. It's the final work, as far as I'm concerned, because I think the semester ends on December 7th. So. I mean, okay. I am willing, if you guys want it that way, I am willing to have, I mean, somebody sent me a mail saying I may not be done with my project by then. I can ask, when will you be done by the project? Because if you are not done by December 7th, which is the end of the semester, if in fact a whole number of people are in a situation where they won't actually be done by December 7th, then I think there is like a final exam for this class, I can make presentations happen that day. But then you need to send me email and you need to see, you know, if huge number of people really think it will make a big difference for their project quality, you know, that could be arranged. Okay. Any other questions? So I am going to continue discussing statistical learning. And so last class, basically, we spent a whole bunch of time getting an idea of the fact that in normal, in full Bayesian learning, essentially there's nothing special about learning at all. Okay, you need a prior over the hypothesis. Okay, and now, in fact, so you need a prior over the hypothesis, and once you have the prior over the hypothesis and you actually see the data coming in, then you are trying to compute the posterior over hypothesis given that you have seen the data. And once you got the posterior over the hypothesis, then you essentially do a cumulative prediction. That is, each hypothesis, according to each hypothesis, what is the prediction for this data? This test data, and then what is the weight of this hypothesis. So you essentially compute the expected prediction with respect, where the expectation is computed with respect to the prior of the hypothesis. Now, one of the tricky things, of course, and then so we started with that, and I said that in terms of trying to figure out how many hypotheses you're keeping track of, in the full Bayesian, you just keep track of the distribution over the hypothesis space. Okay. In the little example we did, there were only five hypotheses. So it was easy enough to keep track of the distribution over hypotheses. If you essentially have, Boolean attributes, which say six Boolean attributes, we found that there'll be 10 power 19 different Boolean functions, which are hypotheses. And then you need to keep track of all their probabilities, basically, the posterior over all of them. Okay. Now, what's interesting, of course, is if you don't have a Boolean attribute, but rather you have a continuous attribute. If instead of having five hypotheses, you essentially have a set of continuous hypotheses. Okay, for example, if I'm tossing a coin that you never saw, if I'm tossing something, there is a probability, and you're trying to predict whether or not the next toss will come up heads. And that depends on what your hypothesis is as to whether this is a fair coin or not. So in general, for the coin, you have a probability P associated with that coin. Okay, that's your hypothesis. You think it's 0.5 coin. That means if you toss it, you will get 0.5 probability heads, 0.5 probability tails. If you think it's a 0.3 coin, then it means 0.3 probability heads, 0.7 probability tails. If you think it's 0.3031 coin, then again, 0.3031 heads and the rest tails. So that's the probabilities that you use to predict the test data, right? Now the question, of course, in this case is you have infinite number of hypotheses. It's a continuous hypothesis space. So these, the candy example was a case of discrete hypothesis space, okay? And then if you went for 6 Boolean attributes, there being 10 power 19 hypotheses, that's still discrete hypothesis, a huge number of them. Now, in the case of continuous hypothesis, we know from the day one that the only way you will ever be able to represent a distribution is as a parameterized distribution. See, if you are in discrete world, you sometimes think that we can get by with a tabular representation for the distribution. Okay? And then even that will give up, that you have to give up when it becomes 10 power 19 different values. Okay? But if you are in a continuous world, you know from the day one that you need like a parameterized distribution because there is no other way of representing distribution. Okay? And then in the case of continuous hypothesis, instead of this summation here, it will be an integration. Right? Because you have here, 5 distinct or 10 distinct hypotheses. With respect to the each hypothesis, what is the probability of the data times the probability of the hypothesis itself, the posterior probability of the hypothesis itself being integrated. Here it's being summed, and if it's a continuous hypothesis space, you integrate it. Now what's interesting actually is it's easier to deal with continuous hypothesis. To get back one more, having mentioned this last time, we said, well, it eventually becomes too painful to handle too many hypotheses. Okay? And so basically, you try to pick the winner, one single hypothesis. That's what I said last time, and that full Bayesian learning is barely ever done. There's a huge caveat to it. In fact, full Bayesian learning can be done for continuous spaces if you really like to. And in fact, I'll discuss full Bayesian learning for continuous hypothesis spaces, because it gives some very interesting insights as to, for example, when does maximum likelihood estimates go RE? And we really believe this is the right thing to do. Bayesian learning is the right thing to do if you had the wherewithal to do it. Okay? So what we would like to do is, what would Bayesian learning say for some of the easy cases, such as coin toss experiment, such as naive-Bayes classifier kind of a scenario? Okay, and then we will find interestingly that some of the band-aids that you have used for naive-Bayes classifiers. How many of you have seen naive-Bayes classifiers before coming to this class? Okay, several of you have seen it, and you have used band-aids for naive-Bayes classifiers. Naive-Bayes classifier is mostly taking counts, except you do what's called Laplacian correction, which is you add a thing to the numerator as well as thing to the denominator. It turns out that actually that can be explained completely from the point of view of Bayesian learning. So you could say that the reason you're making that band-aid is, if you were to do full Bayesian learning, you would be getting that as the estimate. Okay? So that's something that we will discuss today. Okay? And in fact, so I get to do that. So even though in the last class, for example, I showed the hypothesis, the probability of each of the hypotheses varying as the number of samples are seen. Now, each particular point, if you consider those probabilities, that is a posterior distribution after having seen those many samples. And these posterior distributions in the discrete hypothesis case were all tables. They were just, 5 probabilities. In the continuous hypothesis case, would be some parameterized distribution. Okay, so for example, it may have been a normal to begin with, it will become a different normal, maybe, are different something else. In fact, one of the big questions that becomes an issue is, if you are dealing with parameterized representations, can you be closed within the family? Okay, so if you are dealing with tables, who cares, right? I mean, you had five numbers here, you'll have five numbers here, five numbers here, five numbers here, five numbers here. If you decided to have an infinitely large table, then you will have, you know, always you'll have an infinitely large table at each point. But if you decided to represent the prior of the hypothesis using a certain distribution, a parameterized distribution, let's say, you know, a discrete, in the case of discrete, you could use Poisson distribution. Can I use Poisson distribution to begin with? Well, you can, but then right after you do a posterior, what if it's no longer Poisson? What if it becomes something weird? Okay, this is exactly the problem we discussed with the Kalman filtering. Okay, whenever you have continuous variables, you have to deal with parameterized representation. And you have parameterized representation, what if the parameterized, you know, the distribution family keeps changing after every update? Okay, yes, sir. What? That's possible. That's an approximate way of doing things. In fact, that's actually more realistic. The way Bayesian learning is used, when it is used at all, is by actually sampling over hypothesis space. Okay. But for at least the simple cases, we can actually understand how to do it analytically. Okay. Okay, so that's basically where we are going. And so anyway, also last time we mentioned that if we don't do the full Bayesian, then we can do MAP. By the way, this is this analogy I introduced in the class. I wrote a slide after I went back, so you can look at that. So we can do MAP approximation, where you just pick the winner, one single hypothesis. That's, you know, most representative. Okay, even in that case, the question is whether you use the prior on the hypothesis or not. If you use the prior on the hypothesis, that's actually MAP. If you ignore the prior on the hypothesis, then you will get into maximum likelihood, which is the easiest. Okay, and we have mostly, I mean, any of the learning algorithms you have seen until now, mostly probably were derived using MLE, the maximum likelihood estimate. Okay, again, part of what we will do today is to at least know what could go wrong if you're using maximum likelihood estimates. And you wind up using it because that way you don't have to deal with prior. Okay. A big direction right now within machine learning community in general is how to get prior over hypothesis space so that you can use them. For example, one of the things I will try to make a connection to, hopefully by next class, so that I can, if I understand it enough, Gaussian processes, for example, the way to connect them is they provide a way of describing prior over hypothesis space. We will see much simpler versions of it in the, you know, in today, for example, we'll see, you know, beta distribution, for example, which is a kind of a conjugate prior for Bernoulli. Okay, and we'll talk about what conjugate prior is. Okay, so there is an interest in going towards MAP and Bayesian learning because MLE has problems. But I also mentioned last class, MLE, if at all it has problems, it only has problems at a certain level. When does it have problems? Remember, MLE is the only thing statisticians used. The amount of training data is less. If you have tons and tons and tons and tons of training data, then eventually it doesn't matter whether you had a prior or not, because the data, the posterior will change completely because of the data. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. We will actually look at an interesting example a little while later again to say the same point. But if you have large enough data, then you don't really care about MAP and Bayesian learning. But if you have small data, which can actually happen, then you do care about Bayesian and MAP, which actually depend upon priors, and priors can be seen as background knowledge. And as I said last time, human learning, a lot of human learning is very much based in the context of background knowledge. Okay, and so there is a lot of interest in going towards that, but, you know, we'll look at MLE first. Okay. Okay. Now, so what I'm going to do today is essentially talk about density estimation, which is basically the main problem, you know, that is posed in the statistical learning. Okay. So the idea in general task is learning a probability model given a set of data that are assumed to be generated from that model. Okay. So to make life simple, let's assume that all data are in some sort of an attribute form. We're not even going into relational form. Okay. To you'll assume that the all data is, you know, attribute form. So there is x1, x2, etc., xn are the features of each of the data. Some features, they can be continuous, they can be, you know, multinomial, they can be Boolean, you know, right now I don't care. And the issue, of course, is I've seen, you know, each data instance d1 will have values for this. Okay, I've seen these are being generated hopefully by some probability distribution. Okay, so for example, we got into this from the Bayesian networks, graphical models. You know, graphical models are, you know, well connected to, obviously, are well connected to statistical learning. You know, we are essentially trying to think that there is a Bayes network out there, let's say, which is generating the data. Okay, now how would the Bayes network have been? So let's say here is some Bayes network. Okay, so that's a Bayes network, right? So presumably it would have had a prior here, it would have a CPT here, a CPT here, and then a CPT here, and then a CPT here. In fact, it should not be called CPT. T means table, okay? You, if you have continuous variables, you don't expect to have tables, you want to have densities, conditional densities, conditional CPDs, conditional probability distribution, right? So that's what you have here, okay? Now, if I give you this network, if this is the network that's generating the data, then you know how to generate data from a Bayes network, right? So you start from the beginning, if it's a Bayes network, you start from the beginning, with respect to this probability, sample a value for this. Based on this guy's value, then you know which particular row of the CPT you're supposed to look at. Then you will know what's the probability distribution to sample this and this from. Once you have sampled both of those, then you can sample this, and clearly you can sample this because it depends on both of these. So then you have constructed one sample. Okay, so I constructed the assumption underlying statistical learning is, you know, the data are generated by an oracle distribution, okay, which is represented by a graphical model. Okay, and the question is, from the data, can I recover the model? That's what I'm trying to do. From the data, can I recover the model? Okay, so that's called density estimation. That's called estimating the distribution that generated the data. Yeah. So the issue is that in graphical models, there are two kinds of graphical models. Okay. One which we being the 471 folks have talked a lot about, which are Bayesian networks. And then there are another kind of things called Markov networks. In Markov networks, essentially there is no directionality to the nodes. Okay, that's the less important thing. That's the obvious thing. You know, if you look at a picture of a Markov network, there are no arrows. You know, a Bayes network, there are arrows. But actually, theoretically, they're quite different beasts. Okay, you could specify a particular distribution. Suppose you have a distribution P star that you need to represent. Sometimes, there may not be a Bayes network that exactly represents that distribution. In fact, you would then need Markov network. And similarly, you could have a P star dash such that cannot be represented correctly in Markov networks at all. It needs Bayes network. If you have, and there are some which can be represented by either. Okay, and there are some interesting issues. In fact, the second paper that I sent, well, actually I sent it in the wrong, I mean, you may have gotten in the wrong order, but the Kohler-Friedman paper, for example, keeps talking about, you know, making connections to Markov networks as well as Bayes networks. Because that textbook that nice thicker textbook, you know, which basically talks about inference over both Markov networks and Bayes networks, and learning of both Markov networks and Bayes networks. And the interesting thing is there are certain kinds of trade-offs between Bayes networks and Markov networks. One very important thing that will become clear as we go on today, although we won't talk too much about Markov networks here because I don't think any of you know enough about them yet, okay? But one issue is that it turns out that if I give you the Bayes network configuration and if I give you what's called complete data, this will become clear by the time the class is over, then computing the parameters, which is basically the CPT entries, is just each parameter can be computed separately. Okay, so if you have n parameters, then they become decoupled n learning problems. Okay, so the parameters are not connected to each other. Okay, whereas in the Markov networks, they all get connected. That's what's called entanglement. By the way, there is a certain craziness for physics and especially quantum physics terms in statistical learning. I don't know whether you know this, maybe some of you probably heard about this, but for example, entropy is a big thing that we will talk about today too. And you heard about entropy before coming to computer science, you know, it came from thermodynamics, for example, and, you know, statistical physics. And so why did Shannon name information theoretic entropy, entropy? It turns out that von Neumann, who is this jack of all trades, you know, is a very smart guy, he suggested apparently to Shannon that, you know, call that entropy. A, it actually has similarities to real physical entropy, and B, nobody in the world knows what entropy is. And so if you say it's entropy, you're already ahead of the game because nobody has any prior over what the heck you're trying to talk about. So then I can call it, that's one reason you name things such that nobody has any preconceptions about it, okay? So entropy is kind of a hard enough concept even for physics people at that time that he said, you know, use that and then you can look like a you know, very respectable physicist, and they also won't understand what the heck you're talking about. So you can say, it's like the Alice in Wonderland, you know, when I say a word, I want it to mean exactly what I want it to mean, you know, so I can decide that. Anyway, so then there is entanglement, which is parameters getting coupled. You know, if I said coupled, you would have said, what's the big deal? But entanglement looks really nice, you know. And the entanglement exists for Markov networks, even for complete case, okay? And one of the issue is, we'll see actually that because of that, the learning in the Markov network scenarios can be harder, even for complete data, than for Bayes networks. But then there are some other advantages for Markov networks. So if you're coming to this from full graphical network models, then there are all sorts of, you know, additional issues that you need to know. Yes, sir. We will talk about all that. I mean, right now, I just have the data, okay? The question, of course, is I can have variations of learning properties, you know, learning models, learning problems. One where I've been given, in fact, I'm given a data and I'm trying to induce the model. The question, of course, is it just cold start, only data, nothing else? Or do you know a little more about what it is that you're trying to induce? For example, I can tell you, here is the topology of the Bayes network. In which case, I only have to learn the conditional probability tables. I could tell you, here are the important variables. You figure out the topology and you figure out the CPTs. That'll obviously be harder. But that's nothing compared to, here is the world. You figure out which are the relevant variables, how are they connected, and what are their CPTs, which is the hardest learning problem. Okay, so that's really the true learning problem. You know, data doesn't come, one of the biggest things machine learning people continually forget, I mean, especially if you just go into it as an engineering problem, is data never comes with, here are all the relevant attributes. I'm sure the function is exactly the function of all these attributes. It's all sorts of junk. Because of which we are, as I said, you know, at other points in time, you know, we do come up with all kinds of crazy hypotheses. So, for example, black cat coming in front of me in the morning must have caused that accident that day. It's true I did drink and all that fun stuff, but, you know, I think that's not the real reason. It's the black cat. And black cat was part of the data. And so it clearly could be, you know, reasonable hypothesis. It's in the hypothesis space. And it might actually agree with some number of data points just by luck. Okay, so the hardest problem, of course, is you don't even know what are the relevant variables. Every variable is given. In fact, one of the other interesting issues is I might give you a huge number of variables, and then there are some important middle variables that are useful that will reduce the number of parameters to be learned, and I didn't even tell you that they exist. Okay, that also can happen. We will talk about all of this in a couple of slides. Okay, so we are trying to learn the probability model given that data are assumed, you know, generated by that model. Okay, so you know, you think of attributes, you know, chi, and then there's a probability distribution over chi, which is that Bayes network or Markov network or something. Okay, now the original distribution is P star. Really, all that matters, it turns out, is if I started with this Bayes network and generated the data. Okay, remember I told you that there are some distributions which can be represented exactly both by Bayes networks and Markov networks. So if I generated my data using a Bayes network and you computed the equivalent Markov network model, should I yell at you? No, because really all that matters is the full distribution, and if you are able to capture it, it's fine. Right? So ultimately what you're doing is, given this distribution which generated the data, you're trying to find an estimate to it. Okay? And it doesn't have to be in the exact syntactic form that the original distribution was. It only needs to be in the same semantic form. That means the distributions are somehow equal. Now the question is, how do you decide distributions are equal? You know, for that you need to talk about distances between distributions. Okay, so the idea is a distribution is equal to itself, and then given another distribution, there is some distance it has from that other distribution. Okay, and it's actually, there's a nice theory for some information theoretic point of view as to why this works. This is called the relative entropy over two distributions, and it's also called the KL distance, Kullback-Leibler divergence measure, which is the standard way you measure distances between distributions, right? And this makes sense, because supposedly all you're trying to find is P star, and you actually came up with P dash. You want to know how close you are to P star. So if its distance is zero, then P dash is basically in a different syntactic form, but it's same thing as P star. If not, then it's a different thing. Okay, so Kullback-Leibler divergence measure is basically defined as relative entropy, which is essentially expected value taken with respect to P star, with respect to the oracular unknown distribution, okay, of log of P star psi by P dash psi. Okay, so you're taking essentially the ratio of these two distributions at each point, and you're taking the probability of that point itself with respect to the true distribution. And that basically means you're taking the expected value of this quantity. Okay? Now, there are one thing obvious to understand is, if in fact P dash equal to P star at every point, then this would be log of 1 at every point. So it would be 0. So the distance would be 0. That much you can see. Okay? There are more interesting connections, but you know, that's enough for us right now. Okay? So anyway, so this is a good distance measure for distributions, and so if you rewrite it, then you can think of it as, so the problem with this measure is, I don't know P star. Okay, I mean, you can set up an oracular experiment where you start with a known distribution, generate data. In your papers you get to do this, right? You start with a known Bayes network, generate data from it, and then see if your learning algorithm learnt it by looking at the distribution it came up with, compute the KL divergence. That's fine. That's a reasonable thing to do. But in real world, you don't know what the underlying distribution is. Okay, so there's a problem. And so it turns out that you don't have to worry about it as much if you realize that this is nothing but this minus this. Logarithms, division over logarithms is subtraction over logarithms, right? Okay, so now this term only depends on P star. This depends on P dash, which is the estimate. Right? Okay. So now suppose you came up with P dash and your friend came up with P double dash as the estimate, given the same exact data. Okay? Then you have your distance from the true would be this. Your friend's distance with the true would be this minus a different quantity. So this part is the same. So you can just look at this part. Okay, now what's interesting is, when I look at this part, what am I looking at? I'm looking expectation of log likelihood. It's basically, it's log likelihood in a different form. So I'm coming to maximum likelihood estimation from a different direction, from distances between distributions point of view. Okay? So if I ignore this part, and this is what I'm focusing on, then essentially, of course, you might say, well, I still don't know P star. How can I compute expectation with respect to an unknown distribution? If you said this, which is a good thing for you to say, then I would say, well, you know that the data is sampled from P star. Right? So data is a good sample representative of P star. So if you take this log of the log of the likelihood of each data point and sum them up, right? Because since the data points that I'm giving you were sampled from P star, then essentially summing up the likelihoods of each of the data points with respect to the current estimated distribution is exactly what that would be estimating this quantity. Okay? Okay, so that's basically what this is saying. If the data are drawn IID, then the joint likelihood is a product and log terms over all the data instances can be summed, and so that would be an estimate for that. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things is that I'm basically going to be comparing different distributions that I learned based on how good this value is. Okay. Now, so we just want to get a distribution P dash that maximizes this quantity. And that quantity is being computed empirically over the data points. The expectation is being computed over the samples. And assuming that the samples are fair representation of the unknown distribution, okay, then essentially whoever maximizes this would actually be maximizing, whoever maximizes it would be maximizing this whole thing, because this part is the same for every distribution, every candidate distribution. Okay, so that's fine. Now the interesting thing is maximization is an optimization problem. Okay, so essentially what we did right now is we connected density estimation, which is estimation of distributions, to a optimization problem. And so that's how learning becomes an optimization. In statistical learning too. You know, learning becomes optimization in other contexts too, but if you think about it as statistical learning, then it's still learning the distribution, the best distribution is an optimization problem. Yes?
Is this thing,
it's optimization, and you can decide what the loss function is, and you still will have an optimization problem with respect to that. Okay, wait for a second. And there are two reasons why you should wait. Because it will become clear for you as to with the rest of the slides. And second is, you have taken, I guess, machine learning course, and others here did. Okay, and so if I answer right now, other people will be lost. Okay, but I believe I'll answer your question. If not, ask me after the class. Okay, so now coming up to here, all I need is a candidate space of distribution. Right, if I know two candidates, I can always say whether I'm better or worse than my friend. You know, I came with P dash, my friend came up with P double dash, whoever gets it better is the best one. One of the problems when you remove this is none of us can be sure that we got the right candidate. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because when this becomes zero is when you got the exact distribution. Since we are ignoring this part, then all you can see is there is a constant somewhere here, and then I am subtracting one number, my friend is subtracting another number. Okay? And so the question, of course, is all I can say is I'm better than another hypothesis. The real question is, if I have given k hypotheses, I can tell you which of them is better. In fact, if I am given a space of hypotheses, I'm trying to look for the best hypothesis in that. And as I'm saying hypothesis right now, I meant distributions. And so when I said hypothesis prior previously, which is a distribution over hypothesis, in statistical learning, prior would be distribution over distributions. If that doesn't, you know, hurt your head, then you know, it should. Okay, you know, basically, you know, hypothesis prior is a distribution over distributions, because now our hypothesis itself is a distribution. Okay, which is what you're trying to get out of the data. Okay. So now, while we are going there, one of the interesting questions is this bias variance problem. Many of you have heard about it. I just want to tell you my version of it. You know, I'm sure the textbook actually talked about it. I just want to repeat that to some extent, because I think it's important to understand what the problem is, and in fact, why they're called bias and variance problem. Okay. So there are two options, right? One option is we can start with a small class of candidates, or we can start with a large class of candidates. Now, small and large, you know, I'm not going to quantify right now. Suffice it to say that small class of candidates means probably there are a huge number of distributions in the world that cannot be well approximated by any member of this space. It could be infinitely large, but there is no member of this space that would approximate the true distribution you have in mind. A large class, on the other hand, is big enough, it's still infinity, but it's big enough that it will approximate. So for example, you know, in a non-density terms, looking for space of all lines that explain the data, infinite number of lines, or looking for space of all polynomials up to order 2 that will approximate the data. That's also infinity, but that's a bigger infinity. And so there's likelihood that, in fact, what you have in, you know, the true distribution is more likely to be, the true hypothesis is more likely to be found in one of the bigger class members than the smaller class members. Okay? So now here's the question. If I have a small class, then I have too much of a bias. I'm looking only for lines. Okay? In fact, there's this, you know, huge, you know, fun jokes about how psychologists can always find lines irrespective of the data you give them. They'll just keep saying, oh, that's nice, here is a line. Okay? And so if you want to find lines, you will find lines. Okay? Now, so that's a bias. So you're being biased to find lines to some extent. So it's sort of, if the class of distribution is too small, then in some sense, and it's inflexible in the sense it will never really be. There is not even a single member in that class that would come anywhere close to the distribution that you're trying to learn. Okay, then essentially there is going to be an estimation error, right? Even if you get the best line, if the data is like this, the best line would still be doing badly most of the time. Okay, so that's your bias problem. The variance problem, on the other hand, is you'll say, well, instead of lines, let's look for B-splines. Okay, the problem with B-splines, basically, you know, any polynomial, of, you know, any order polynomial, is that I can always, you can give any number of points, you can fit a nice smooth B-spline to those points. That's why B-splines are useful. In fact, B-splines are used to kind of, you know, any of you have taken Gerald Farin's class, right? You know, B-splines, I mean, he used to have this thing where he would represent the Mercedes-Benz. He's from Germany. He doesn't do, you know, General Motors car. So he would look at B-splines to represent the shape of the bonnet of a Mercedes-Benz. Okay? And so he will actually give, that way essentially, rather than remember every point, he is remembering parameterized B-splines, which will take much fewer parameters than the number of points. However, they're actually very good at pretty much fitting to any number of points. They're great in reducing the loss over the training data. But the problem with that is, remember that the training data is being generated from a real model, right? Now, this is being generated probabilistically. So you tossed a coin here, you sampled here, you tossed a coin here, sampled here, sampled here, and you took 10 samples this time. Next time you again took another 10 samples. Next time again you took another 10 samples. If every time you take 10 samples, some sample would be different. It's just part of sampling. Now a B-spline will now correctly fit to this new 10 samples. Okay? Which means for small changes in training data, the hypothesis completely changes. The parametric form of B-spline might completely change. What that means then is on the same test data, your performance is going to be highly variable. That's where the word variance comes from. Okay? You can fit well to the training data if you have a large class, but then your performance is highly variable because the training data is variable. It's only sampling from a true distribution. Unless the sample size is like infinite, and you know, there is a chance that the samples are basically going to be different at each time. Okay, yes?
Class in common distribution.
Yeah. No, a small class, for example, would mean that I will only look at binomial distributions, let's say. That's a small class. I'll only look at multinomial distributions. I won't look at anything more. Okay? So that's the kind of thing. So binomial distributions, there are infinite number of them. Just as lines, there are infinite number of lines. That's the issue. Okay? And in particular, what happens in the Bayes network, essentially, is actually that, you know, if I am basically not given the topology, if I'm not given the topology, and I have, x1 to xn variables, I can construct any kind of Bayes network I feel like. I can construct a naive Bayes network. Just because I constructed a naive Bayes network, is that the way the world is working? No. So in fact, remember, for those of you who know MBC, so naive Bayes network, you have x1 to xn as the features, and there are special kind of features, y1, let's say, which is also really part of the data. Okay, and that is what you want to predict. We'll get to that in a minute. Classification task is slightly less general than learning the full distribution. Okay, but if you're trying to do that, then what happened? X1, xn somehow are causing, somehow are related to y1, and then given these values of the features, you want to predict the class. How is it supposed to be? How is the way the Bayes network that you put there, the topology of the Bayes network, changes the family of distributions you're going to look for? Do you understand this? Those of you who kind of definitely did not ever sleep in 471 might remember the following thinking cap question I asked, which is, your friend basically came up with data, and you showed him a Bayes network. And they say, so there is a bunch of data, and your friend says, here's the Bayes network that underlies this data. Can you prove your friend to be wrong once in a while? Sometimes you can, because Bayes network essentially generates only a certain class of distributions. Even if I just give you the topology of the Bayes network, it still would not allow certain other kinds of distributions. A Bayes network exactly encodes certain independence assumptions. And if your data doesn't have those independence assumptions, then your Bayes network is not a good approximation to your data. So whenever I made a hypothesis as to the topology of the Bayes network, I have decided the class of distribution. In NBC, you made a very strong hypothesis, because what you say there is the class variable y causes every one of the features independently. This is the distribution. This is the Bayes network you're going to find. What if really the distribution is like this? X1 causes x2. And x2 and x1 together cause x3, and x3 and x2 cause x4, and x4 causes y. Or maybe like this, y causes all of these. Then obviously, A distribution that is consistent with this could be quite far away from a distribution that's consistent with this. That's what I mean by class of distributions. I mean, if you only have, in the pre-graphical models world, we tend to think in terms of binomial distributions, multinomial distributions, etc. Now we really tend to think of graphical model with these little binomials and multinomials sitting in the CPDs. You really are talking about very interesting kinds of distributions that don't have a simple parameterized model that anybody ever studied in continuous probability distributions. Okay? But when I give you this topology that restricts the class, and really all of those questions can be thought about for which class should you look at. If I only look for naive Bayes models, then I have restricted the class. If I'm looking for multi-layer Bayes networks, I kept it much more open. But then I'll spend a lot of time, because it turns out many, many networks are going to be just as well consistent, as consistent with the data. And you have to figure out which of them is better. Yeah. So that's the issue of, then basically, again, the same issue. Any random data, you'll wind up coming up with a slightly different deep Bayes network. I mean, when I say deep, you know, multi-layer Bayes network. Whereas, if the data changes slightly, you will still be able to come up with the same naive Bayes network. You're likely to come up with the same naive Bayes network. So in one case, the high bias reduced your variance. Okay, in the other case, the high expressivity increased your variance. What? Yeah, you can do that. Start now, and one day you die, you ask your child to start doing it, and then it'll never be done, basically. This it's impossible to do. Okay. So there's a bias variance problem. You know, you heard about it before, you heard it again once more, I guess. So the standard solution says limit attention to a reasonable class of distribution. Now, how do you know which are the reasonable class? That's sort of prior information. Okay? And then R allows a large class of distributions but penalize the more complex ones, which essentially means I'm no longer really going to compare distributions over just that quantity. So I came up with, you know, my log likelihood is, let's say, 1,200. Okay? My friend's log likelihood is, only 1,190. So it looks as if I'm winning. Actually, log likelihoods are normally negative, but, you know, let's look at it this way, okay? And I'm winning, except mine is a B-spline of the 15th order. My friend is going by with a straight line. Did you see what I'm saying? Okay? So then, obviously, I'll say I'll go with my friend because the complexity of his hypothesis, the penalty he's getting for the complexity of the hypothesis is lower than the penalty I'm getting for mine. Okay? That is what is called regularization. This is all the jargon. For those of you who have taken machine learning, you should know this all, you know, I assume. And, you know, those of you who didn't, you may have heard about it. Regularization essentially is penalizing the hypothesis that you think are too complex. Okay? So anything other than the likelihood. Now, I would argue that you do not have needed regularization if you had priors. If you did the true Bayesian learning, you won't need regularization. Because Bayesian learning, the prior over the hypothesis provides all that is needed. That's what is actually doing the regularization there. And MLE, when it loses that ability, then has to separately put a penalty. Okay? Anyway, so where am I now? I forgot to get my watch, and I'm totally, completely atemporal today, even more so than normally. Okay, so one more thing I want to go. So I was in density estimation, one slide over, and then I talked about bias and variance, two slides over, and then before I go into the textbook stuff that you already read, I also want to talk about this generative versus discriminative learning. Okay. The interesting thing is, in this case, the picture I provided is there is a Bayes network that's generating the data, recover the entire Bayes network. That's the general problem. I mean, recover the entire distribution. Okay? So, however, in some cases, that's the most general kind of learning. You know, that's maybe you might be interested in doing that. Okay? But in many cases, what happens is you really couldn't care less about all the features. There are certain special features of the data called class labels that you want to predict. Okay? So in this Bayes network, maybe let's say this is a label that I want to be able to predict. All of these other guys are features. Those of you who came to learning from the classification side, that's what your base point is. You always think there is data and there is a class label. From a probabilistic point of view, data and its label is data. The entire thing comes out once, right? If it, for example, if I provide a probabilistic, if I provided a naive Bayes classifier for the class and the features, and if I generated data from it, I will get the class as well as the features for each part of the data, for each instance of the data. The fact that I only care about this is secondary, okay? So if I am looking at predicting only a subset of the variables, so such as I have, if I can split the total number of attributes into two disjoint subsets, X and Y, such that they, basically you partitioned the total number of attributes of the data into set X and set Y, and Y is the class variable, and X is the feature for you. Okay? Then what you're really interested in is figuring, you know, all the, in on your training data, the testing basically that I'm doing, so on your test data, all I would care about is I'll give you X's and I'll ask you to predict the Y's. Okay? Whereas that is, even if you knew how to do that, you would not have been able to do this. Would you agree? So suppose somebody who has an idea of given the symptoms can predict what the disease is. That's all they can do. Given the symptoms, they can predict what the disease is. And that's what, you know, you really want to do as a doctor. Okay? But somebody else who actually constructed the entire model of how natural causes lead to diseases which lead to symptoms, and they computed the entire distribution, they found a good estimate for that, then for them this is just a subroutine. It's just a sub problem of the bigger problem they are solving. They can actually, you can take this model, go to Mars and restart human civilization with the same exact diseases in the same way we have it here. Now you might say, why do I want to do that? But it's a good thing, right? I mean, I'm actually able to completely reproduce the data. This bigger idea is called generative learning. You are essentially learning how to generate the entire data along with the label. It's the more general learning problem. However, it's a too big a hammer if what you really care about is just classification, which sometimes you do. You know, classification is not the only thing you are interested in, but, you know, if you go by what's going on in, you know, ICML these days, it's like that's the only thing they care about. Okay? So if you only, if you really are caring about classification, then what I'm finding there is, so if I have X and Y as a subset of the features, then density estimation essentially is trying to estimate P of X and Y together, the joint distribution. Remember, that was the bedrock of all Bayes networks, you know, Bayes networks, Markov networks, they're all trying to represent joint distribution over a subset, a set of variables. Okay? And so statistical learning, essentially the generative version, tries to estimate the P of joint distribution of X and Y. But if you only care about Y, then you might be able to get by with just P Y given X, which is the conditional distribution. So you learn only the conditional distribution, not the joint distribution. Okay? If now a given classification problem, so if you want to do generate, that is, if you want to actually generate the same diseases on Mars as you have here, you have to go with generative model. If you want to generate natural language that sort of looks like the language that people generate, you need generative models. If you want to generate documents, pseudo documents, that can fool Google into thinking they are like rest of the world's documents, you need generative models. Okay? However, if all you are interested in is seeing, taking a mail and checking whether it is spam or not, you can get by with a classification problem which can either be solved with generative models or be solved with discriminative models. And when both can be done, things get interesting. Things kind of get interesting as to who is right, which is the best way to go. Now, so that's what I want to spend in a slide on describing. Okay. So the idea is generative versus discriminative. In a way of looking at it, really there is not much of a difference if you go to the source of how to define joint distribution PXY. Okay. It can be defined using chain rule as, remember, y is the class variable if it's a classification task, and x is a non-class variable. It's just normal feature. And if there is no difference, then they're all the same. Okay. Now, PYX can be written as P of y and P times x given y, P of x given y. That's one way of writing it as a chain rule. The other is P of x and P of y given x. Another way. They're both equal. Okay. So it's like asking, what do you mean, should I write 3 as 1 plus 2 or 2 plus 1? Okay. However, interestingly, there are religious works. Remember when, I mean, many days back, you know, maybe not in this class, maybe 471, I talked about progression versus regression, the never-ending war. And, you know, machine learning also, they have their own religious wars. And one nice religious war is discriminative versus generative learning, the never-ending war. Okay? And so, essentially, nobody wins. And what you really want to understand is the trade-offs as to when what would be a good idea. Okay? So now, first of all, generative learning, naive-Bayes classifier is a generative model. Because I just showed you, right, that if I have this, you know, naive-Bayes classifier as the, you know, as the model that I learned for my data, then from that, I can generate totally the new data points, including their labels as well as features. Okay? Discriminative learning, you probably haven't thought about it before if you haven't done any machine learning course, but those of you who have done logistic regression, for example, that's a classic regression model, classic discriminative learning model. In fact, you can solve the same problem using naive-Bayes classifier or logistic learning, okay, logistic regression. And so the question is, who would be better? Okay. What I'm more interested in figuring out is, you know, why one of them could be better. Okay. And so here are the reasons. Here are the, you know, main points. So generative learning, as I said, I hope I said it enough number of times, is more general problem. Okay. It's like I'm asking you to pass this class, and you're saying, I will first get a Turing Award in, you know, computer science with AI as my background, and then, of course, you would then be, you know, riddled with guilt and give me an A plus. It's true. Okay, I will give you an A plus if you do that, you know, preferably before December 7th. After that, you know, all bets are off. But it's too much of an overkill. There are easier ways of getting a good grade here than that. Okay, so generative learning is more general. After all, if you have PYX, you can predict not only Y given X, but also some of the X's given other X's. You can complete data. Data completion problem, for example, if I have a data item with some features missing, I should be able to predict what the missing features are. That can be done if I have a generative model. Okay? Because I have done more than what is needed. Okay? Discriminative learning, on the other hand, is more to the point. It essentially is only computing the conditional Y given the X features. Okay? Now, so that basically, and it basically ignores, since it doesn't care about, so P of YX, this is basically P of X and P of Y given X, and it's only really caring about this. So it's completely ignoring this. So it doesn't need to know the prior over the features. Now, what does that mean? If I don't have to model the prior over the features, then I don't have to model the dependencies between the features. Now, in probabilistic reasoning, dependencies are the bad things, right? If everybody is independent of everybody, happy things happen, computationally, right? And in general, to do generative models and still be done, and if you're not the god, and you know, and you cannot actually do generative model or fully expressive class of distribution while taking into account the right kind of regularization, then you would use bias just to make generative model possible, generative learning possible. And the bias would essentially introduce large number of independent assumptions. Not because you believe those are true in the data, but because you feel like, because that would make your life easy, right? Naive-Bayes classifier, for example, assumes class variable independently causes each one of the input features. Is that true? Did you ever bother to check? Actually, many a time, you know that's not true. It's like completely not true. Okay, so for example, this class variable would be mail is spam or not spam. And these features would be, it has the word Viagra. It has, you know, the following sentence. It has, it came from Rav. All these things. Okay, now they could be related. I might be a Viagra salesman and I might be sending you mails, you know, including both of them. Right? So there are possible connections between variables and you're just ignoring them. Okay, and are you right in ignoring them? Not really. Now the real question is, why do you care whether I'm right or wrong? As long as I'm doing well on the classification, I'm fine. And in fact, one of the interesting things we talked about, you know, when we talked about naive-based classifier in 471, I believe, you must have talked about in other classes too, is they're pretty darn good. Even when independence assumptions, there is no reason to believe independence assumptions hold, they kind of do quite well. So actually searching for your keys under the street light, even if you didn't lose them, there is a reasonable thing. Because in the dark, you can't search for anything anyway. That's more or less what, you know, naive-based classifiers are doing. However, the interesting thing is, while naive-based networks do seem to do fine, in fact, in the cases where naive-based classifiers work well, if you use discriminative models, such as logistic regression, they work even better. Why? Because they, if naive-based classifiers have to take into account correlation between variables, they have to change the, they basically, there are variations of naive-based networks which are no longer that naive, okay? So it's like instead of capital NBC, there's small NBC, that means less naive, okay? Now how will they be less naive? They'll say class, and they'll say X1, X2, okay, these two guys have a connection. The rest are still independent. So I introduce some of the correlations between variables. And then anytime I introduce an extra edge, one of the interesting things in Bayes networks in particular is if the amount of samples you need to learn a distribution is linearly proportional to the number of parameters you need to learn. Okay? And the number of parameters of a network, which is the entries in the conditional probability table, are exponentially proportional to the number of edges in the network. Right? Because if I have m parents, if a node in the Bayes network has m parents, it would need 2 power m probabilities. So it's exponentially larger. So every time I throw in an extra line, right, I'm basically increasing the number of samples needed exponentially. Okay? So since I would not be able to learn, basically that would not be naive-based classifier, it will be real Bayes network classifier, it will be a larger model. And so to reduce, since I don't know, I don't want to handle that, what I would do is I'll put huge bias such as independence assumptions, like in NBC. Because of which my accuracy can worsen. Whereas this guy doesn't have to do that. Discriminative side doesn't have to do that because excess only stay in the conditioning evidence and they can all be completely correlated. In fact, one of the most popular, currently popular discriminative learning frameworks is not logistic regression, which is kind of too simple, although that's the thing that you should try anytime you need to try something. Conditional random fields. Okay? Conditional random fields is all the rage and they are essentially, the word conditional in the conditional random field is basically saying you are learning the conditional distribution. Okay, and one of the interesting things in CRFs, and in fact, you know, they talk about this a lot, is in CRFs, you can define features which are obviously correlated with each other and don't have to worry about it. Okay, whereas if you did that in NBC, the more features are correlated with each other, you know the less accurate the prediction is going to be. Okay, so that's the good part. This makes it sound as if discriminative learning will win. Okay, but with freedom comes, I mean, if I give you enough rope, you can hang yourself. Okay, and if you have too much freedom, that essentially means you can overfit. Okay, so the weirdest thing is that sometimes where both naive-based classifiers and logistic regression can be used, naive-based classifier might actually work better. Why? because essentially the extra bias that naive-Bayes classifier is using wound up reducing the variance. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's like you cannot say that my friend who only looks for lines is any smarter than me who look for B-splines normally, because B-splines contain lines, right? But you can say it in machine learning, because if you're looking for B-splines and you are not penalizing the complexity of the spline, then you are likely to overfit to the data and you are likely to have variance on the prediction. Okay, so in this very weird way, your computational limitations, I mean, this is sort of, I mean, reminds me of, I have seen, I mean, I hope this won't happen in this class, but I have seen in other classes where I give the same exam for in class under time pressure, and they get to do it also at home without any time pressure, okay, and I grade both of them in many four-level classes. You know, there would be enough pathological cases, not always, but there will be enough pathological cases where they would have done worse when given more time, because they have actually thought, maybe I'm thinking wrong, let me think a little bit more, and they'll get the wrong answer. Okay, that's sort of weirdly what is happening here, because how can you say that the independence assumptions you made are actually better? It's just that this allows you enough rope to overfit. Okay, so that's a beautiful, I think it's actually something that you keep hearing in statistical learning, and so I thought you should hear about it. Now the question, of course, is, in the rest of the class today, I'll be talking about taxonomy of tasks, and maybe just start talking about how to do this on Bayes networks. Now, will I do generative learning as well as discriminative learning? I will do generative learning, because naive-Bayes classifiers are generative learning. Okay, and for technical reasons that are actually sort of hinted at in the chapter I sent you, discriminative learning is actually easier to do for Markov networks than for Bayes networks. Okay, and so you don't see that many discriminative learning techniques for Bayes networks. Okay, so I won't do any discriminative learning techniques here, but you should know the difference. Okay, because that's a huge foundational difference. CRFs are basically Markov networks. They are undirected models where you're only learning the conditional distribution. Okay, so the last, next thing is taxonomy of tasks. Okay, and more or less I mentioned it earlier. You could have essentially two kinds of constraints in the learning problem itself. The zeroth level, in fact, three kinds. The zeroth level is if you're learning graphical models, what kind of graphical models? Are you going to learn Markov networks or Bayes networks? As I said, there are enough distributions in the world that can be represented exactly by both. And what's more, you never really want to estimate anything exactly. You just want to get a good enough estimate. And there may be a good enough estimate in Markov networks as well as in Bayes networks. Okay. By the way, in fact, one interesting connection is logistic regression. If you read the introductory papers on conditional random fields, they will start by saying logistic regression is the simplest conditional random field. You can actually view logistic regression as a conditional Markov network. Okay. So that's that connection. So it too is actually not Bayes network. Okay. So you get to decide which one you're learning. That's a bias, okay. Then the question is, part of the learning problem, I may have given you topology, at least, in which case you only have to learn the CPTs. I may not have given you topology, I'll just give you the relevant attributes. And then the question, of course, is you need to learn both the topology and the CPTs. Now the interesting question there is, essentially, you have to, you could do it jointly, or you could just say a discrete search over a set of topologies and a continuous search over for each topology the best parameters. Nice combination of both continuous optimization and discrete optimization. The thing that makes it even more maddening is that if you are not careful, and if you just go by MLE, which is maximum likelihood, right? If I have currently a particular hypothesis which looks like this, y1, x2, right? That's my model. Okay, that has a certain maximum, like that has a certain maximum likelihood for the data. If I add an edge to the existing network, maximum likelihood cannot go down. This is one of those kinds of crazy things where, remember, you know, for the K means, you know, what is the right number of clusters to look for? Well, just keep increasing the clusters. The problem is, if you increase the clusters, the cluster dissimilarity, intra-cluster dissimilarity can never increase. If you become smaller and smaller such that you are just yourself in a cluster, you are extremely similar to yourself. That's a useless clustering. Right? And the same sort of thing happens in searching over topologies too, because essentially adding an edge, in fact, it's slightly technical to show, I don't know that I can show it myself, but adding an edge essentially increases the likelihood of the data. So it looks as if always adding more and more edges would be a better thing to do. That'll increase the number of parameters to learn. At some point of time, you have a completely connected network which requires 10 billion parameters to be learned from 1500 samples. How can you convert 1500 samples into 10 billion different parameters? Impossible. Well, I mean, it's possible if you just make up numbers. Okay? So in those cases, learning, basically, you're making the learning harder and harder. Okay? So, but anyway, there are, you know, mostly we won't talk about, the textbook has a chapter on, you know, searching over topologies. Not a chapter, a section on searching over topologies, but they don't really go that deep into it. Okay? This bigger book has more, you know, heuristic algorithms for that. Okay? Then the last is, we don't even know what the relevant attributes are. That means you first have to figure out the attributes, then assign a topology, then find the parameters. And obviously, the difficulty of learning goes higher this way. Now, the question, of course, is how is the difficulty in Bayes network versus Markov network itself? And I mentioned earlier that, you know, it's sort of not a dominance relation. You know, for example, for complete data cases, Bayes networks are easy to learn. Complete data, given the full topology, Bayes network learning is no different from what you already know for naive Bayes network learning. You know how to do naive Bayes network learning, right? Because you just took counts, you know, and then computed the conditional probabilities for each. Now, if I give you a deeper network, you would still find the parameters in that network in the same exact way. Just essentially, each parameter is separately estimated from the data. Okay, for Markov networks, the parameters get coupled. For even Bayes networks, the parameters can get coupled if you wind up using parameterized distributions in the CPDs, where the same parameter winds up taking part in multiple CPDs. Then you basically, it wasn't coupled, but you made a coupling by putting the same, same CPD across. That reduces the number of, parameters you have to learn, but then it also makes the learning problem harder. Okay. Now the interesting thing is, normally I mentioned, and obviously we can only get to it next class, but I mentioned here that you are trying to optimize this quantity with respect to a set of hypotheses. Normally they are continuous space of hypotheses, so this would be a continuous optimization problem. It has to be a continuous optimization problem. Did you do a continuous optimization in learning naive Bayes network? No. And you have Bayes networks to thank for it. Because under certain cases, you don't need to do the full optimization problem. Because, for example, the parameters can be independently assessed. But for Markov networks, you actually have to do the optimization. So, for example, you might need to do something like Newton-Raphson to actually take gradient descent to look for the minimum over a multidimensional function. That's when the true optimization part comes in. Okay? Till now, the reason you haven't seen it is because it wasn't needed. For the easy cases, especially the completely specified data over a known topology, it's easy. Okay? But it doesn't always have to be that way. Okay? On the other side, the other thing is, I keep saying completely specified data, what do I mean? Okay? The question is, I said each data point has n attributes, x1 to xn. Is each data point specified with all the attributes known? Is it a complete assignment or is it a partial assignment? Okay. Furthermore, so if it is complete, that means every attribute has a value in every data point, that's complete assignment. That's the easy case. The second easy case is incomplete data. That means some attributes are missing from some of the data points, but no attribute is missing across all data points. This is like null values in databases. Okay, so sometimes I might forget to give the height of a person. Sometimes I might forget to give the model, the manufacturer of a car, saying everybody with any brain will know a car are made by Honda, so I'll just not write it. Okay, but somebody else will write, methodical people would have written Accord, Honda, and from the rest of the data you can predict that the missing value here is Honda. So that's incomplete data. The worst is hidden attributes. The hidden attribute is, this is an attribute that's missing across all the data points. So it's not really part of anything that you can ever observe. Then you might say, why do you want to learn it? Well, remember, if I have a network which I have m nodes here and n nodes here, and pretty much everything is connected to everything, and it turns out there is an interior node, if you can say, something called the condition of the car, which you cannot sense, but everything affects the condition of the car, and condition of the car affects everything below. If you do it this way, the number of parameters you need is much smaller. If I remove this, then the number of parameters I'll need is, because everybody is connecting to everybody, so it's a complete network over m nodes and n nodes, and you have exponentially more number of parameters to learn. So you hypothesize hidden variables to reduce the complexity of learning. Even if the world doesn't actually think, even if there is no such thing as car condition, we would manufacture one, because that would make the problem actually feasible to solve. If, saying I'll have this network, I'll learn the big network, is impossible, because if you need, as I said, 1 million parameters and you have 1,000 cars from which to learn these parameters, you may as well give up. What are you going to do? Okay, so hidden variables will come because you would be forced to introduce hidden variables to reduce, to make the learning problem tractable, so that the number of parameters are reduced. Okay, but then when you introduce hidden variables, you take the chance that no data point will ever give you the value for the hidden variable. So that essentially involves that you no longer can separately compute each parameter's value by counts. Then what you really need to do is you need to hypothesize a value for the hidden variable that will complete the network, complete the data, then try to, from the completed data, learn the network. Given the network, then find what should be the middle value, and then redo this whole thing. This is called what? This is called magic, but it's also called EM, expectation maximization algorithm. Okay? And K-means does that, by the way. How do K-means work? How does K-means work? If you're looking for K-means clustering, you ask K people to stand here, and then say, everybody, you go to the guy who you like. And then after they go there, then they look around and say, oh, actually, I like that group better. So they will change all over again. And pretty soon, the clusters will stabilize. That's the expectation maximization going on there. We will actually, in fact, talk about a version of K-means called mixture of Gaussians. If I generated data from a mixture of K-Gaussians, and then I'm trying to figure out what Gaussians actually generated this data, then I need to figure out the mu's and sigmas of each of the Gaussians. That's a nice, interesting version of the clustering problem, where you have clusters generated, but they're generated by hidden variables, mu and sigma. You're going to find that. So next class, when we come, we'll talk about as much as we can about next class and the class after that, about the simpler cases first, which is learning from complete data, and then talk also about map learning for complete data. Then after that, we'll stop Bayesian and map learning. We'll just stick to MLE, which is maximum likelihood, and then talk about the EM, expectation maximization algorithm for hidden data. That's it.